anyway, so you never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? Have a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
Well, when you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. I'll be with you until 7 o'clock. How are you doing? It was not as hot today as it was supposed to be. Isn't that a great thing? I was so very happy. Sure started out like it was going to, though. Boy, at the farmer's market early this morning at about 9:30 in Sebastopol, it was really already broiling, but then it just kind of fizzled out. Before I introduce this evening's guest, I have to tell you what I did this afternoon. Marisa Gugiana has been a guest here on Mouthful before. She has Sonoma Direct. She's also one of the people who helped get the Sonoma County Meat Buyers Club going. And she's just a little firebrand. She thinks up so many great things to do. And she had Tamar Adler, who is a butcher. She's also been a cook down at Chez Panisse. She's a journalist before that, and she is headed back to New York to do a nine-month program for mid-career journalists at Columbia University. Well, she had a workshop today, a class on butchering, and I think there were six of us in the class, and we broke down a leg of lamb, boned out a chicken. And then she broke down a whole side of pork. And it was just really interesting watching how she worked because it's, you know, butchering is an art and it's in part anatomy. It's anatomy and gravity and a whole lot of intuition. And I've done these things before. I've never broken down a side of pork before, but I've certainly boned a whole lot of lamb in my time and plenty of chickens. But still, to be part of this group and to do some of the work myself and watch Tamar, who's really talented at it, it was really fascinating. And I hope that they're able to find someone who will step in while Tamar is back in New York, because I'd like to do a show on the class. I was actually going to record it today, and my equipment got stubborn. It wouldn't work. That seems to be going around recording equipment lately. Anyway, I'll let you know if there are more classes coming up, because it's really a very interesting thing to do. And then you go home with all of these great, fabulous meats and chicken all raised around here and get to have a feast for a week. So on that note, I'm going to introduce my guest. It is Daphne Miller. She is a doctor. She is the author of The Jungle Effect. She teaches at University of California in San Francisco and is in private practice also in San Francisco. Welcome to Mouthful.
Thank you so much, Michelle. It's great to be here.
Now, The Jungle Effect has just come out in paperback, right?
That is correct, this week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Birth a second time.
A little bit easier, I would think, than the first
smaller
time around. When did it first come out in hardcover?
It came out a little over a year ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think it must have done well. If it's come out already in paperback,
one never wants to jinx oneself, but yeah,
it's good. I was hoping that it had. You know, America seems to have an insatiable appetite for diet books, but this one is so thoughtful, and you know, there's so much real science behind it. Thinking, well, I hope people have the attention span to pay attention to this because it's really fascinating. We should say the subtitle. It's The Healthiest Diets from Around the World, Why They Work, and How to Make Them Work for You. So my first question is, one hears, you know, just out and about listening to people talk about food, you always hear that in medical school, doctors get like 4 hours of nutrition studies and not much else. Is that true? And what made you get really interested in the way nutrition affects us?
Well, for me, 4 hours would probably have been an overestimation.
Oh, really? So you don't get much?
I really hardly anything at all. And the only nutrition that I really recall getting in medical school, and I graduated from medical school in 1993, so things might have changed a little since then, but not much. The only nutrition I got was for caring for very sick patients in an intensive care unit setting and how to hang the proper nutrients in their IV bags. So
really
next to no nutrition at all. And then I got out in the real world and started to take care of patients as a family doctor. And you suddenly realize that most of what ails us is at least in part related to what we eat. As a matter of fact, I think the statistic is something like 80% of heart attacks, strokes, and cancers are traced back to either poor diet, lack of exercise, or smoking. And as a physician, I realized that I was absolutely inequipped to deal with one of the most major issues that was facing my patients, which is issues with their diet. So it really, for me, was a gradual path that I went along, learning more and more about food. And at first, my studies were very formal, just studying nutrition the way it tends to be taught in graduate school of nutrition and so on. I think what we would call standard nutrition dogma. And then I think I slowly started to get more and more off the traditional path as things revealed themselves.
And how did you find, did you find your patients receptive to talking about, you know, nutrition and diet and how they eat, that sort of thing?
Well, now my patients seek me out specifically for that. I think at first patients were absolutely amazed that there was a doctor who wanted to talk to him about nutrition. But I do feel that more and more physicians are pursuing this now. And I have a wonderful network of colleagues who are also interested in diet and specifically in whole foods, not just prescribing supplements or following reduced diets or supplement diets. You know?
So how did you set out to study what became the jungle effect? How did you find what are considered the healthiest diets around the world, that sort of thing?
It really was a mandate from my patients to help them find a way to eat to stay healthy that was not a one-size-fits-all diet. I spent years watching people follow one fad diet after another that had been invented at a point in time by physician or nutritionist or supermodel and watch them try it for a while, get very into it, lose pounds, feel better, and then usually fall off the wagon, so to speak. And because these diets really didn't have any specific appeal or personal meaning for them. And then I had a really interesting experience with one specific patient who I talk about in the first part of the book. Her name was Angela, and she grew up in Brazil and spent quite a bit of time in the jungle in a very traditional community there that was on the banks of the Amazon River. And then she came to the States, and by the time I saw her, she was in her late 30s and had developed a series of health problems. She was pre-diabetic, and her blood pressure was starting to go up, and she developed arthritis in her knees and was struggling with her weight and was struggling with depression. And she told me a really interesting story. She told me that about 6 months earlier, she had gone back to her native village in Brazil. And while she was there, all her health problems had slowly started to disappear. And she said she wasn't even trying. And if anything, she felt she was eating more and exercising less than she had in San Francisco. And then she came back to San Francisco, and slowly everything started to get worse again. And she came to see me. She wanted to find out what was causing this jungle effect. And as luck will have it, about 6 months later, I ended up in that very same region of the world.
Really?
I was volunteering down there. And I was working in a little remote clinic in the middle of nowhere. I was spelling one of the doctors who usually works there who needed to take a vacation. And while I was working in the clinic, I saw lots of elderly people, and I saw really interesting diseases that I don't see in the United States, things like snake bite and machete wounds. But I didn't see any of the chronic illnesses that I see on a day-to-day basis in my office in San Francisco. I didn't see the hypertension or the diabetes or the depression or the arthritis. And I started to take a closer look, and one of the things that was most striking was the diet. It was a traditional diet that had grown up in that region, mm-hmm. made of local foods, and that made sense, that had not been invented at one point in time, but that made sense because they had been handed down generation to generation in that mm-hmm. area. And they were foods that went together in the perfect way. And we talk about survival of the fittest when it comes to humans. These were survival of the fittest diets.
Mm-hmm. And what happened with Angela? Did she eventually go back to eating in that style?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because while I was in this region, I was there for the whole summer working, I collected recipes for her, and I brought them back to San Francisco, and as best as we could put them together, because obviously we didn't have the hearts of palm jungle spaghetti or things that I could find down there, but I gave her the recipes, and it was really one of the first times that I had prescribed recipes for a patient.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very groundbreaking moment for me. And it was certainly the first time that she had ever received a prescription of a recipe from a doctor. And she went home and started cooking them and started to feel many of the same benefits that she'd had while she was in Brazil on vacation. And it really was a light bulb moment for me where I thought, you know what, I can go around the world collecting recipes for my patients and finding diets that resonate with them from areas where people are not experiencing the chronic diseases that we tend to experience here in the United States.
That's just so interesting. But it makes me wonder, she was from there. Would the same thing work for someone with the same symptoms who wasn't?
That's a wonderful question. And at first, part of my thought was that what I was going to do was create this blueprint for allowing people from a different cultural area or ethnicity to go back and reclaim their own cultural mm-hmm. foods and their own heritage. And that really was how the project started. But the more I delved into it, the more I traveled, and the more I talked to experts here in the United States who know about nutrigenomics or the link between our genes and our health, I realized that it really doesn't matter so much which diet you follow as long as you're not following the standard American diet.
Uh-huh.
And of course, there are certain ways that our genes have evolved in one zone to work specifically with certain foods, but less so than you would think. And uh-huh. so when people ask me that, I say, yeah, there are probably some foods that work a little better for you than others, but mostly to find traditional ways of eating that taste delicious to you and that resonate with you.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that the manner of eating in these particular areas, was that also influential?
Enormously so.
Uh-huh.
It's not only what you eat, but how you eat it, for sure. And I came back, I had my notebooks from my travels, and one of my notebooks was just filled with little pearls and lessons on everything from table manners to traditions around food. And that really is one of the richest parts of my project. Mm-hmm. And I really do talk about that in each of the regions that I travel to. Mm-hmm. Within the book, I talk about the customs and styles of eating and the way that families hand things down to the next generation.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Mouthful, my guest, Daphne Miller.
I crashed into the jungle while trying trying to keep a date with my little girl who was back in the States. I was stranded in the jungle, afraid and alone, trying to figure a way to get a message back home. But I was out of know that the wreckage of my plane had been picked up and spotted in my girl in Lover's Lane. And meanwhile, back in the States.
Baby, baby, let me romance. You know your old-time love, yeah, haven't got a chance. He's standing in the jungle, glad as he can be. So come on, Rudy, baby, just you and me.
It's Mouthful. We are talking with Daphne Miller. Dr. Daphne, as her patients call her, she's your board-certified family physician. Did I say it right?
Yes,
I did.
That is absolutely correct.
Great. The book is The Jungle Effect. I want to talk a little bit about the organization because it's so interesting, Section 2. But first I have to tell you, I was thinking about you today when we were breaking down that pig because she kept saying, now don't throw this part away. Use this to make lard. Use this to make lard. And you recommend lard.
You know, I was fascinated by your description of the butchery because the first thing that went that I thought of as you were describing learning these butchering techniques is some of the experiences I've had overseas in these communities watching meat being butchered for a ceremony. And if you've spent any time learning how to break down an animal, you really understand what a precious commodity meat is. Yeah. I think if we all became butchers and actually broke apart our own meat, we would value meat a heck of a lot more.
Absolutely. And, you know, how precious and also how, I mean, that intuitive link, you know, it's like here's the knee, here's this protective coating, you know, this protective layer, which is the lard, and we can work with that. It's good for us. So in Section 2, you have you're broken down both geographically and by disease. So you have, for example, Copper Canyon, Mexico, a cold spot for diabetes. And this goes on through several, up through Chapter 10, including the absolutely fascinating Iceland, a cold spot for depression. So would you explain what the cold spot, this cold spot concept?
What happened was when I started to become interested in visiting these areas and looking at the traditional diet, I became especially interested in going to zones that had a very, very low rate of one specific chronic disease that afflicts us here in the United States. And as a result, I picked an area that had very low rates of diabetes, another area that had very low rates of colon cancer, another area that had low rates of depression, and so on. Mm-hmm. Copper Canyon, which you mentioned, was fascinating to me because geographically, it is the area that was closest to the United States. Mm-hmm. It's in northern Mexico, in the Barrancas de Cobre, or the Copper Canyon area of the Chihuahua, the state of Chihuahua. And deep in the canyons there, you find the Tarahumara Indians, who are a traditional group that's been living there for thousands of years and has worked really hard to push back a lot of the modernity that's seeped its way into the rest of Mexico. And what's fascinating about the Tarahumara is that they are the genetic cousins to the Pima Indians of Arizona.
And, oh, interesting.
Yeah, the Pima Indians of Arizona have some of the highest rates of diabetes in the world. By the time you are an adult Pima, you have a 40 to 50% chance of having adult onset diabetes. And here are the Tarahumara, who are their blood relatives, who have some of the lowest rates of diabetes. So what do we learn from that? It's definitely not genes that are the major factor here, right? And I was very curious to go and figure out what the Tarahumarans that were eating that gave them these distinctively low rates of diabetes.
And so what is it? What are they?
Well, big surprise to me was that they're eating an awful lot of carbohydrates. And we're classically taught, especially in medical school, but I think all of us have this perspective that carbohydrates raise your blood sugar. And
yeah, if you eat too many carbohydrates, you're going to give yourself diabetes.
Right, and we're very much focused on these low-carb diets, or a little less so now. About 5 years ago, they were sort of all the rage. But it really has to do with the type of carbs. Mm-hmm. And the tarahumara are eating these very unprocessed carbohydrates. They're eating what they call the three sisters or the tres hermanas. And it's corn and beans and squash that are eaten very much like they come out of the earth. They're cooked mm-hmm. into stews and so on and not eaten in a highly processed form. And even the tortillas that they make are made with coarsely ground local corn that's treated with lime and absolutely delicious. Oh, so good. But very different than the highly processed tortillas that we tend to mm-hmm. buy here.
And what role does lard play in their diet? We're on that.
Lard had a curious role in so many of the diets that I saw. I mean, it turns out that lard is actually a very healthy fat if it's taken from a healthy pig. Getting mm-hmm. back to that whole meat and local meat yeah. issue, if your pig's out eating free-range grass and not being fed a lot of antibiotics and hormones and processed grains themselves, you're going to get a pig that actually is quite rich in omega-3 fats and quite rich in monosaturated fats, monounsaturated mm-hmm. fats, the same that you get in olive oil, uh-huh. for example, and that has a really quite a healthy profile, and it's a delicious type of fat that you can add just a little bit to a big pot of beans, and it will go yeah. a long way in terms of flavor.
Yeah. Now, that always, whenever I hear anyone, including in your book, hear that mentioned, reminds me of my grandmother and how she kept, and I think everyone at that time did, they kept bacon drippings on the stove. And, you know, there was the little strainer. They'd pour in the hot bacon fat. And then if they were sautéing onions or green beans or whatever, they'd put in just like half a teaspoon of these bacon drippings. And it would make a whole pot of whatever just taste absolutely delicious.
Well, Michelle, I invite you to come into my kitchen because I have that little can of bacon
drippings.
Oh, you do? Oh,
wonderful.
Right there.
I do too.
You just have to really make sure when you're cooking, for example, your bacon, mm-hmm. that it's good quality bacon. Yeah. Comes from a good source because the fat is really the part that holds. If there are going to be pesticides or hormones mm-hmm. or antibiotics, that's where you're going to get it, is mm-hmm. in the fat. They're all fat soluble. But so you make sure you have a good quality bacon, and then you have to make sure that you don't burn it because that will turn it into an unhealthy fat. So mm-hmm. as long as it stays nice and clear.
A little bit more about that. Talk a little bit about burning, and does it have to be blackened before you've altered it?
If you're starting to get that noxious smoke in your nose mm-hmm. and
then you've
seeing,
gone too far.
And your eyes are watering a little bit, and mm-hmm. Preferably, it really should be a clear colored oil as mm-hmm. it's cooking off. Mm-hmm. And what I tend to do is I pour it off bit by bit, just mm-hmm. in case I go too far towards the end. I don't ruin the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
But it's amazing how long it can keep at room temperature. I actually haven't even tested the shelf life because I keep on adding more to the can.
Yeah, it seems to have an almost indefinite shelf life. Let's move on now to Iceland. This was the most counterintuitive thing for me. I think anyone who lives on the West Coast, you have friends who move here from Portland, who move here from Seattle and say, oh, I was so depressed all winter. And so there's a sort of expectation or this idea that when you go north and it's dark for a long time, there's a lot of depression. But you didn't find that in studying Iceland. You found that there was none of that seasonal affective disorder sort of depression thing, right?
Yeah, well, hopefully now with the new economy there, these statistics haven't changed.
Yeah.
But the fascinating thing is in Iceland is what the researchers call the depression paradox. And that exactly, here's their neighboring country, Finland, has some of the highest rates of depression in the world. Certainly some of the highest
suicide rates,
seasonal affective disorder, postpartum depression, even bipolar depression. And here's their neighbor, Iceland, that has some of the lowest rates, especially for that region. And there's a whole group of researchers trying to figure out why. And one of the operative theories is that Icelanders eat so many omega-3 rich foods. They have, when you measure the concentration of omega-3 fats in their blood, they're really quite high, and certainly higher than a lot of other people from neighboring countries. And omega-3 fats, as we now know, are wonderful for helping with nerve transmission, for helping with brain health, and even pretty conventional psychiatrists are using them now as at least an adjunct to treating treating depression.
Really?
So they will use them along with an antidepressant
now,
and
do
put
they
people
use them
on fish oil.
So they do it as a supplement?
Sometimes as a supplement, and sometimes for mild depression, we'll just put people on fish oil to start with. So the researchers thought at first that the reason that Icelanders were so undepressed was because they were eating a ton of fish, and that would be the natural conclusion because it's a big fishing culture. But then they realized that a lot of Icelanders who also had these high levels of omega-3 fats weren't really eating so much fish at all. They were eating a lot of lamb. And they lived more in the center of the country. They didn't have such access to the coast, and their main protein source was lamb, not fish. So they went and they tested the blood levels of omega-3 fats in the lamb. These researchers were very creative in their question, in their way of approaching the question. And they found that the omega-3 fats in the blood of the lambs were also very high. So they said, well, how can this be? Maybe the lambs are eating fish. That was their first conclusion. It turns out, no, the lambs are not eating fish. What's happening is that they're eating the little Arctic tundra, this little grass that forms every year, and that this grass is very filled with something called alpha-linolenic acid, which is a omega-3 type fat, which is a precursor to the type of omega-3 fat that you find in fish. And the lamb are converting this to omega-3 fats. And so when the Icelanders are eating the lamb, they're getting a good source of it. And it turns out when they're drinking the milk of the cows who are also grazing on this grass, they're getting a great source of it. And when they're eating the cheese as well.
So that's almost like an accident of geography, it sounds like. You know, it's what was there.
It's what was there.
Yeah,
although
that's really interesting.
Free-range animals all over the world
have, yeah,
and wild animals all over the world, and even our organic animals here in the U.S. that are not necessarily free-range seem to have a much healthier fat profile than conventionally confined animals. And so this is not a license to go out and go hog wild, so to speak, and eat piles and piles of meat. But it's certainly, those are the types of meats that I would choose if I were eating meat. And I would eat it in moderation.
And have you treated people or given people the advice, people who are depressed, to look into this Icelandic diet? And what kind of results do you see?
Wonderful results, and I absolutely do encourage people, especially, and this is an instance where I think culture and tradition really do play in, especially if they are from northern ancestry and are really drawn to these types of foods, it could be a nice match. The story I tell in the book is about one patient whose parents and grandparents were Scandinavian, and she described herself as a dough dog and a vegetable hater.
This was Christine,
yes,
right? Yes, Christine.
Yes.
I loved reading about it. How did she do?
She did wonderfully. And
She didn't sound like she was at all interested in eating vegetables.
When she came to see me, she told me, look, I defy you to find a diet that will work for me, given the caveat that I will not eat a pile of leafy greens ever. And I said, okay. And so it was really exciting for me when I found out that most Icelanders hate vegetables too. I said, you can be a vegetable hater and still be healthy. Eureka.
That is really great. That's good news to a lot of people, I think.
Oh, help me, please, doctor. I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's a pain. Can't you please tear it out and preserve it right there in that jar? Oh, help me, please, mama. I'm sickening. It's today, that's the day of the plunge.
It's Mouthful. Thanks for sticking with us. It's the last Sunday. It's the last Sunday in June, isn't it? Wow, the year is half over. How did that happen? It's going to be July, Lawrence. Did you know that?
Not my fault.
It's not your fault, and I was blaming you. We're talking with Daphne Miller, or Dr. Daphne, author of The Jungle Effect, which has just come out in paperback book, in paperback. We've talked about Copper Canyon, Mexico, a cold spot for diabetes, Iceland, a cold spot for depression. I want to go to Crete now. Not just a cold spot for heart disease, but it sounds like, you know, getting closer maybe to what is really meant by the Mediterranean diet. Because there was a time, let's say in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, where I think a lot of people thought that Mediterranean diet meant you could eat as much pasta as you wanted as long as you poured a lot of olive oil on it and drank a whole bunch of red wine with it.
Right. When you actually look at the map, the Mediterranean's a pretty big sea, and you realize there's a lot of different countries around there, and that what we're eating here probably had very little to do with any of them. The reason that I went to Crete was because it really is ground zero for the research that's been done on the Mediterranean diet. And I tried to link each one of these chapters back to the actual epidemiological research that was done. These cold spots, as I refer to them, places with low rates of chronic disease, are actually established as such by studies, by biomedical studies that were done. And on Crete, I went there to figure out what it was that they were eating that was giving the elder folks on Crete such low rates of heart disease. And it was a really fascinating time because I traveled all around the island. I talked to everybody from chefs to grocers to food producers, and everybody, based on their own bias, had a different lesson to teach me. I met a gentleman named Yorgos, who was an olive oil producer whose family had been doing it for generations. And he said, "Don't believe what anybody else says. It's the olive oil." He said, "My grandparents," and he brought me over to his screensaver on his computer, and there was this really handsome elderly couple. He said, "Look at these folks. They each live to be over 100. And between the two of them, they drank 50 kilos of olive oil a year." He said, "You tell that to your readers." So
that's a lot of olive oil.
That was his perspective. And let's see, I met a guy named Stelios who ran an organic grocery store in Hania, a little town on Crete, or actually a little city on Crete. And he showed me the grains in his store, these incredible whole grains, like barley and cracked barley and so on. And he said, "It's really the bread, this heavenly rusks that they make on Crete," which are these things that you really need your molars to crack open. You know?
Yeah.
He said, "These are the secret to longevity." And then I went and spent time with a woman who ran a taverna. Her name was Katerina. And she took me out orta picking. And orta is this amazing tradition they have on Crete where everybody goes out and picks for wild greens. They take their knife and their fingernail and they go up into the hillside with a plastic bag and pick their wild greens. And it's really a knowledge that's handed down from parent to child of which greens are okay to pick and which aren't. And clearly I had no idea. I came back with a basket really full of weeds, but she was terrific at it. And we ate them with olive oil, and delicious. And she said, "These are the healing foods of Crete." This is this woman with no nutrition training at all. She said, "These are filled with antioxidants." So everybody had their own perspective. I met a guy named Nikos who actually worked as a waiter in an old-fashioned taverna there. And he served me some raki, which is this eau de vie grape must that will just take the roof of your head off, you know. And he put a liter of it down the table. He said, "Drink this. I drink a liter each day and look how healthy I am." You know, he looked terrific. He said, "I'm over 50. Look how great I am." I don't know quite whether I'm going to follow his advice because, you know, after a couple sips, I nearly passed out on the cobblestones.
Oh, some of those indigenous alcohols. Oh, my goodness.
But it was interesting. I was so overwhelmed by all the information I had during my time on Crete. And then I went back and I was looking at research that had been done by a very famous Greek researcher named Antonio Trikopoulou, who's published in all the most prominent medical journals here in the United States. And apparently she, too, was really curious about which were the most healing foods on Crete. So she did this really elaborate, very sophisticated study where she assigned each food on Crete a value and then ran these numbers, ran them through a very complex statistical analysis to find out which were contributing towards heart attacks and which were protecting towards heart attacks. And these were what she called odds ratio for our hazard ratios for death. And what she found is that basically what we would presume to be the healthy foods did little to improve risk of heart attacks or, you know, decrease risk. And what we look at as unhealthy foods like the meat or the lots of dairy or sweets even really did nothing to worsen your risk of heart attack. And I looked at those numbers and I said, boy, maybe she did the study wrong. We all know that vegetables are incredibly good for you and, you know, lots of meat is not so good for you. And then I realized that part of the reason that the data came out looking that way was because you can't reduce a diet down to its individual bits. What's so amazing about the diet from Crete is the way that the foods interact, the food synergy, the way that the lemon interacts with the wild greens and interacts with the olive oil and the million little chemical processes that are going on that we probably haven't even identified yet. But who cares? Because it tastes delicious.
It tastes good, yeah. It's like people who want to take garlic pills instead of eating garlic, or they want to find what is it that's good for you in red wine so we can put it in a pill and just take the pill.
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, I decided, forget all this. I'm just bringing home recipes. You know, that's really going to be the science for me.
Yeah, and that's a really great part of the book, as is at the end of each chapter you have how to eat like an Icelandian. Is that the right way to say it?
An Icelandic.
Icelandic. Yes. And you have it in three stages. I think that that's really helpful. But one thing I wanted to touch on, we left Iceland, but we're going back now because I think this is really fascinating. And I had heard, we've heard for a long time that a number of things can raise your cholesterol level, including being stressed out that your cholesterol level might be too high. So here you have this, the chocolate and the symbolic connection between food and mood, and that if you think chocolate is bad for you, you might get depressed after eating it.
Well, there's a number of foods that seem to have that role, but I was really interested to see that first of all, a lot of people feel that chocolate will make them very buzzy, but it actually it's not caffeine so much in chocolate as theobromine, which is actually a distant cousin of marijuana, as it turns out.
Oh, really?
So, but it gives you more of a euphoric feeling than a real buzzy feeling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it doesn't really act like caffeine. But what I was mentioning in the book was that a lot of times our perception of how foods act in our body actually will cause that action to occur. And I was talking specifically about studies showing that when you can give people something that tastes sweet and that might not even have sugar in it, that's more of an alcohol sugar, like a diabetic sugar. Mm-hmm. But if they fear that this is going to raise their blood sugar, sometimes they can actually document increases in blood sugar. Mm-hmm. And this is something that researchers have done. So it's not just the way that foods act objectively in their body. It's the way we perceive foods to act that also might have some of its effect.
Mm-hmm. And then, you also talked about with infants, post-surgery, infants in intensive care, that suckling on sugar water or something that they would perceive as sweet had as much pain-killing effect as a narcotic?
That's another study that illustrates this. And once again, with that study, what they did was they gave some of the infants something that was sweet that was not glucose, but that just tasted sweet and it had the same benefit. So it's clearly taste
that has an effect. And it provides that much physiological comfort, not just emotional comfort.
Absolutely. So I do feel that taste is part of our medicine. It's not just mm-hmm. the foods themselves, but it's eating delicious foods mm-hmm. that also happen to be healthy.
That flies in the face of this pervasive attitude in America, which, lucky for me, I never had this attitude. And I don't know why, but I heard Larry King say this once. He had a nutritionist on his show or someone talking about food. And he said, well, the basic rule is that if it tastes good, then it's bad for you, right? And we wouldn't eat if the only things that kept us alive tasted bad, because we'd have no motivation.
No, all these diets that I was able to visit had absolutely delicious foods to offer. I think what happens is that our palates have been deadened by what people refer to as the highly palatable foods, which are really what we get in our standard American diet, the high fructose corn syrup mm-hmm. and the corn oils and the salt and the deep fried. But once you wipe those clear, you know, they are fogging everything up. And once you wipe those clear, there's a world of amazing, subtle tastes that are behind that, that are just absolutely terrific. But I think that it's hard to taste them if you have those clouding the picture.
Interesting. So the goal isn't to eat what's good for you. The goal is to eat delicious things that are also good for you.
That is perfectly put.
So now we're getting to the recipe section. Cold spot recipes, it is called. You have it divided by region. Tell me about it. So you just went to these regions and you brought back recipes.
Yes, and I also brought back shopping lists, because I think, you know, I had to be very practical about this. So I actually broke down the foods not only into shopping lists, but also food sections for those who are still, you know, who are using supermarkets. And for me, the recipes really are the medicine. Mm-hmm. I think it's really easy to get very excited about 10 superfoods or whatever. But the question is, what do you do with those foods? And mm-hmm. for most people, it really the problem is getting home in the evening after a long day at work and figuring out how to nourish themselves. Yeah. You're exhausted. Your kids are screaming. At least my kids are at the end of the day. And the last thing you can do is really start cooking an elaborate meal. And the good news is that most traditional cooks also have a lot on their plate, you know.
Yeah.
And so these recipes tend to be very simple and easy to accomplish. Some of them are slow cooked, so you start them in the morning. And I'm a big believer in purchasing a crock pot so you can...
Absolutely.
Yeah, make these
There's
easy.
I mean, traditionally, like a crock pot.
It's done over a little charcoal fire and mm-hmm. set to cook all day, but most of us don't have those in our kitchen anymore. So.
Well, just an example in this Copper Canyon, Mexico, these are not recipes that sound exotic or weird, not if you're in California anyway. Tortillas, eggs wrapped in a tortilla, salsa, home-cooked beans, and sautéed nopale cactus. I was at the Sebastopol Farmers Market today, and there was Hector with freshly picked Nepalese paddles.
Wonderful.
And they're so good.
They're delicious.
I love Nepalese.
Yeah,
just
so many people don't know how to cook them, and they're very, very easy to
cook.
Very
easy.
They're kind of in the okra family in terms of how they taste and act. And I love to grill them, and then I just slice them up diagonally and toss them with a little bit of lime and garlic. It's, delicious.
Even just wrapped in a tortilla,
mm-hmm.
After you slice them, then chop them and put them, toss them with some corn. They're really good.
Well, Nepalese are such a great example of a traditional food that has some really interesting healing qualities. They actually have a substance in them that's similar to metformin, which is a diabetes medication.
Oh, really?
And so you realize that a lot of these traditional diets and Nepalese are eaten by the Tarahumara. So not only are they eating these slow carbs, they're actually eating their diabetes medicine.
Here's some more. Let's see. Mountain stream fish with cilantro and vegetables, three sisters stew, chicken pozole soup. Pozole, one of my favorite things in the world. Oranges with cinnamon. Cinnamon seems to come up in several places. Cameroon, we haven't talked about Cameroon yet. Cameroon, in Africa, low incidence of intestinal problems, it sounds like.
That's right. Cold spot for colon cancer and other problems. Yeah, cinnamon also lowers blood sugar and allows blood sugar to be released more slowly into the bloodstream. So another one of those traditional spices that has a medicinal benefit. Uh-huh. And, yeah, one of my favorite desserts that I had in Copper Canyon was just sliced oranges sprinkled with cinnamon. Delicious.
That just sounds perfect.
And you can chill it, and then it's just, oh, they're wonderful.
And I know in Sicily, oranges with black pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it seems a little in that same vein, and it's one of my favorite things in the world. Let's talk a little bit about African cooking oils, partly because there's something I know not that much about. And you have palm oil, sesame oil, and peanut oil. Palm fruit oil is something for a long time we heard, bad, 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 stay away from it. And it's actually used in lots of parts of the world, and it's pretty positive oil, isn't it?
The palm fruit, not the palm kernel. The palm kernel, which is what they use in a lot of low-quality foods,
right.
is not very good for you. It actually has a very bad fat profile.
Uh-huh.
But palm fruit oil is, although it's a saturated fat, mm-hmm. it seems like it's quite a healthy saturated fat. The issue with palm oils in general is an environmental issue, that it's very lucrative to grow palm for the oils.
So they can take out parts of the rainforest.
Exactly. So that's, you know, unless it's sustainably grown and it really certified to that, I tell people to steer away from it just mm-hmm. more for environmental reasons. I don't know how many orangutans have died to put more palm fruit on the market. And so that is an issue. But where I spent time in Cameroon in West Africa, it was really local gardens that they would harvest their own palm fruit, and then it's one of those traditional oils that's very easy to process. You really can even do it yourself, you know, with a mm-hmm. press. And by the way, I use that when people ask me, how do I tell a healthy oil from a not healthy oil? I say, if you can make that oil mm-hmm. with a grindstone or even with a metate, which is the traditional Mexican way of uh-huh. grinding, you know, by hand with a stone against another stone, then that is a healthy oil. If you need modern technology and high
ethylene
heat
oxide
and ethylene, all that, then it's not a healthy oil. For example, olive oil is a wonderful traditional oil, easy to make with a grindstone, right?
Yeah, I know somebody, I won't say who, I don't want to embarrass him, but he now produces olive oil. He made his first few batches in a food processor. I think he ground the olives in a food processor and then used some sort of vise to
just squeeze
it out.
Yeah, well, I actually have seen parts of the world where people just stomp on them, mm-hmm. stomp on the ripe olives and get it out that way. So.
And we haven't even gotten to Okinawa, which was one of my favorite chapters, partly because you gave me permission, not that I need it because I'll do anything, but I drink so much tea. And you say, drink as much as you can stand. It's really good for you.
Well, it's really presumed to be one of the reasons that they have such low rates of glandular cancer there in mm-hmm. Okinawa. And that's why I went there, was to understand why it was that the elderly population had such low rates of breast and prostate cancer. So.
And what's the role that fermented foods, especially, I mean, I think of Okinawa in that region, and the next thing you know, I'm thinking about Korea, it's not that far away, and kimchi, and all the fermented foods. So, and just Japan, that whole area there. What's the role of natural fermentation in foods?
Well, natural fermentation in Japan gives you just an astounding array of pickles and fermented mm-hmm. tofu and sauces and relishes and so on. But I found throughout all the regions that I visited that fermentation is really a very key component of the traditional diet. And I think one of the very important healing parts of that. I mean, in the States, we're all very excited about taking our probiotics these days. But once again, you know, you have the supplement versus whole foods that can do this. And probably the most common fermented food that we get our hands on here, other than the occasional truly fermented beer, is yogurt. But there's many wonderful possibilities for fermentation, everything from fermented grains to fermented breads to sauerkraut to making your own relishes, and all of these foods, what they have in common is very healthy yeast and bacteria, which help populate the gut. And the researchers are just beginning to understand what a positive effect this has, not only on intestinal health, but on preventing allergies and eczema and possibly even asthma. And some research that I learned about as I was writing the book was the link between fermented foods in your diet and lower rates of colon polyp formation. And colon polyps are sort of the precursor to colon cancer. So it may very well be protective against colon cancer as well.
And on that note, we are out of time. Daphne Miller, author of The Jungle Effect, The Healthiest Diets from Around the World, Why They Work and How to Make Them Work for You. It is from Harper, out this week in paperback. It is $14.95. It's a bargain, a good recipe section, and just a fascinating and informative read. And you came all the way up from San Francisco, and I really appreciate you being here.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much, Michelle, for having me.
You bet. And I hope this the paperback does as well as the hardcover has done. Meet me back here next week. Actually, it won't be me. It will be my voice. I'm taking next Sunday off. But we'll have something yummy for you here on Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. Take care of yourself, and I'll see you back here soon.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.